Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Certain images engrave themselves on your mind and conscience. They come unexpected and unforeseen, and once seen cannot be unseen. You will have your own. Mine begin with that picture of a child fleeing American napalm bombing in Vietnam. My latest one was a piece of video where I watched a woman standing on a pavement in a suburb of Birmingham a few weeks ago. She was approached by a group of police. They appeared focused and incongruously determined. She was demure, respectable, passive and alone, standing still, doing nothing. They approached her not to ask her if she needed help, as the optics might have prepared one for, but instead to ask her, was she praying? When she answered she was, they told her she was under arrest and took her to a police station, where they asked her what she'd been praying about. This was so bizarre, so contrary to all the expectations of our civilized society, it was actually hard to believe it had really happened. We've been casually using the adjective Orwellian for half a century, and there, on a film, would the British police now become the British thought police? A quiet, demure, civilized Catholic woman had been arrested for praying silently in her heart on the streets of Birmingham, England. What has brought us here? A few things are obvious. We've transplanted the visceral American culture wars at the point where abortion clinics became totems of a new religion, a religion where, in a form of almost inconceivable splitting, womanhood has turned against motherhood. The splitting continues in removing the connection between sex and procreation, and we split off the inconvenient children and destroy them. What we didn't expect was that the death of the innocent children would be accompanied by the death of free speech, that the legalized onslaught against the sanctity of life in the womb would spill over into a legalized onslaught against the sanctity of conscience. We didn't expect public space protection orders intended to help control teenagers in their antisocial angst would become the formalized prototype zones for thought control. We didn't expect the abortion clinic to put to death the values of our civilization along with our pre-born children. Free speech, the integrity of conscience. Who better to help us make sense of all these strands than the woman who was arrested for praying, Isabel Vaughan Spruce, accompanied by Lorcan Price, a barrister who works for ADF, who is well placed to help us understand the role of the law in this Gordian knot of conflicting human rights. And I'm very pleased to say they join me now. Well, I'm delighted to be joined by Isabel Vaughan Spruce and Lorcan Price. Lorcan, are you working for the ADF?
Yes. I'm a barrister, and I do work for ADF International and UK.
Splendid. That's wonderful. And Izzy, you have leapt to prominence all over public media with the dubious honour of having been arrested for saying your prayers. So, first of all, I think a lot of people would like me to thank you for your courage, for your integrity, for everything you've done for the unborn. As a very brief introduction, I was a BBC presenter once, and I was converted to the cause of anti-abortionism on air as some annoying lady phoned up to bend my ear on the faith and ethics program I had about the evils of abortion, which I hadn't really taken much notice of. And so I Googled to see how many terminations there have been since the Act. And at that particular time, which was about 2008, I think, it was 6 million. And on air, I said, 6 million, that's a Holocaust. Because for me, that's the Holocaust number. And I was hauled onto my boss's red carpet the following morning and told that if I ever made a remark like that again, I'd be sacked summarily in the middle of the show. And that was the moment that I gained a sense of the scale of what was happening, even if I hadn't joined the theological dots. So I want to apologize for being late to the party, but I'm here now. Izzy, would you please tell us? So first of all, you've been bearing witness for the unborn for some time. Tell us a bit about your background and how you came to be arrested in Birmingham.
Yeah, so I've been doing the work that I do for probably around 20 years. So that means pretty much every week I go outside an abortion center on offer help and alternatives to anyone who wants that. And despite what many might believe, there's a lot of women who are going to an abortion centre simply because they don't feel there's any other choice. It's not that they've chosen abortion. It's because that they feel that is the only option, which, as we can see, doesn't really mean there's an option at all. And many, many women, certainly well over 100 women have accepted that help. That's just the ones that we know of. Many take a leaflet and say they're going to have another thing and might get back to us. So I've been doing this for about 20 years. Part of that, probably for about 10, 12 years, I've organised 40 Days for Life, which many people will be familiar with, 40 days of prayer and fasting and public witness to help provide alternatives to abortion. So I organised that in Birmingham. And I think it was September last year, the council in Birmingham brought in what's called a PSPO, so that's a public space protection order. And that means that certain behaviour is banned in a certain area, and the area was around that abortion centre that we were offering help at. So the behaviour that was banned was, well, one of the behaviours named was protesting. So when we held our next 40 Days for Life, although we don't protest as part of 40 Days for Life, we're just simply there in twos or threes offering leaflets of help. We did actually go outside the bounds of the PSPO to do that. But in November, December, four times I went inside the PSPO. That was when the abortion centre was closed. And I was just silently praying near the abortion centre. So just to reiterate, the PSPO didn't ban me. It doesn't ban people. It just bans certain types of behaviour. So I didn't go inside the PSPO to protest. I just went inside there to silently pray, which is what I was doing on each of those four occasions.
If the police can ask you this, I don't see why I can't. Izzy, what were you praying for? And why were you praying?
So I was praying actually at the time for, and this is what I told the police as well, for people like my friend Amy, who was raped and became pregnant and was pressured into having an abortion, which she deeply regretted. For people like my friend Natalia, who took the abortion pills and ended up passing her child at home and threw that child down the toilet, which totally traumatized her. For people like my friend Kirsty, who also took the abortion pills and ended up passing her child in her bed. And she described seeing what looked like a scene from a horror movie in her bed. So it's for people like these that I was praying, and many, many more women and men who are also hurt by abortion. And yes, the police did ask me that in the police station.
I think it's important to ask what one's praying for. That's very helpful. And the extraordinary thing is that these buffer zones, these public space protection orders, they're new. I think a lot of people will be aware that the culture wars in terms of abortion, pro and anti, have developed faster in the United States than they have over here. And it seems to me that, like, as with so many things, we've inherited to some extent the intensity of what's been going on there without actually having generated it ourselves. So, I mean, I think in English and British culture, there is no sense in the media that one of the things that happens is kind, concerned Catholics gathering to pray near abortion centers. No one would know that. But the legal and cultural response seems to me to be imported directly from America, where the stakes have been higher for a long time. Is that right? Does that explain something of the draconian and unyielding nature of the legislation that councils have reached for to stop this happening?
I think part of the problem is we have become very intolerant of any views that are different to our own in today's society, hence the fact that we have all this kind of cancel culture that goes on in many places. We hear about it a lot at universities. But it's simply that people want to silence any opinion which is different to theirs, and particularly abortion being such a considered such a kind of countercultural or controversial topic. It's just wanted to be cancelled nowadays. But the sad thing is what we do when we go outside abortion centres is in the public view, you know, 12 hours a day with what we're doing. And at any time, people can photograph us, video us, which has been done on numerous occasions. Everyone's got a phone on them nowadays. If anything that was being done that was antisocial, let alone criminal, why has it not been shown by now? In all the evidence that I saw when the PSPO came in Birmingham, and I was shown numerous pieces of so-called evidence, it was just two people standing quietly nearby, sometimes holding a leaflet. We don't even have any signs or any posters with what we're doing. We've never had that where we are. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but we never have. We're simply just standing there quietly saying our prayers and offering help.
So philosophically or psychologically, what you've become, a victim of feminist propaganda. I mean, you know, my body, my choice. Everyone wants to be a feminist. Everyone's being persuaded to be a feminist. And is this part of the kind of reflex baggage of being a feminist in order to be cool, in order to be accepted, in order to be with the zeitgeist? Everyone's a feminist. And so this is anti-feminist behavior and therefore antisocial behavior psychologically. Would that describe the reflex, do you think?
The sad thing is, I think sometimes it comes from a very kind of misguided place. Very rarely do I experience a bad reaction from those going into the abortion centre. It's often people who think they are helping those going into an abortion centre, who think that they will find us offensive. And in the end, there's been so many lies spread about what we've done. The amount of newspaper articles I've read about our own campaign that just bear no resemblance whatsoever to what we're doing. You know, when I read it, I think, gosh, I wouldn't want to go anywhere near a campaign that was run like that.
Sure.
But in the end, as we know, lies stick and people believe that. And then maybe understandably are concerned, thinking, well, if people are standing outside with huge placards shouting murder at women and chasing them down the street, well, of course, that would be grossly offensive and inappropriate. So it's very hard to actually get across sometimes what the truth is, because we're never given, or very rarely given, an opportunity to share that. And nobody really wants to hear from the women who we have helped and who have been very grateful for us being there, or maybe the women who haven't been offered that alternative and are very sad that they weren't. Those voices are the ones that really are silenced.
So you're talking quite rightly about the level of human suffering that mothers who are pregnant experience at the hands of the whole abortion culture. But one of the things that never happens, as you quite rightly say, is there isn't any articulation of the reasons for it. So Catholics are simply people who have, in this regard, looked at the scientific evidence, and science is unable to produce a moment between conception and birth when the viability of the fetus is deemed to be human. There is no moment. It's a sliding scale. So you either say, as those who choose to give abortion up to birth, well, it isn't human until, and then even then they don't have an agreed scientific moment. It's philosophically imposed. Or else you say it's human from the moment of conception, because we don't have any other evidence and this seems to fit the facts. And that's what a Catholic says. That's the philosophical reason for being against abortion, because it's a living child from the moment of conception. But this never appears to be part of the public argument or the public awareness of debate, does it?
No, and also I think people maybe fail to recognise the impact that has on the women. You know, I know as Catholics we're often talking about, and understandably and rightly so, the child whose life is lost through abortion. But I think sometimes we can sidestep the huge damage that can be done to women through abortion. You know, like, we work very closely with Rachel's Vineyard, which is an organisation that helps anyone who's been hurt by abortion, women or men, directly or indirectly. And, you know, the amount of people I know who've gone through the Rachel's Vineyard help that they provide and the healing that they provide, and that the stories I hear from them of how deeply they have been hurt by the abortion, and also in the lead up to that. Abortion isn't just something that happens in isolation. A woman doesn't just wake up one morning and think, I'll have an abortion today. She's often been set up for it through her life. The amount of women that I speak to who've been coerced and in very coercive relationships, and there's been various surveys done which have helped support that information, showing that many women going for abortions do feel that they're under pressure to do that, to have an abortion.
And there's no doubt at all. As decades as a parish priest, one of the things I discovered was that if the dark echo that having an abortion leaves produces a level of pain that was utterly disproportionate to the public imagination, a pain that stays with the mother, both psychologically and I think probably many people would think spiritually for a very long time. In other words, it's not just, as you're quite rightly saying, it's not a random act that's painful at the time. It casts, not unlike suicide, it casts a very long shadow for a considerable period of time. And that's one of the reasons those of us who've had experience of this take it so seriously.
Yeah, I mean, one of the women who helped with our, I mean, we have many women who helped with our campaign who are themselves post-abortive, and that's why they come and help, because they want to make sure that people are offered the alternatives that they weren't. And I was talking to one of the women who's part of our campaign the other day, and I mean, she'd had multiple abortions, the amount of children she'd lost to abortion, you know, in double figures. And she was explaining the abuse that she went through that led up to her pregnancy. She would then be told to go and get an abortion, which she would dutifully do. And when she'd had the abortion, she would go back to the same abusive situations. And the cycle would just repeat itself again and again and again, because the underlying problems that she was facing were never really dealt with. The problems weren't the pregnancies. The problems were the situations that she was in that led up to the pregnancy. And the abortion centre didn't help at all with any of those. It just left her to go back into those situations. And those are the sort of things that we will often be helping with, women who are in relationships. And
The political paradox, or even political contradiction, is that if you're looking for the real feminist, it's you. You're the people who are actually looking after the women who are most vulnerable and most oppressed and most suffering, if you like. I mean, there are two kinds of support for women, a kind of an indulgent kind and a therapeutic kind. The indulgent kind is a political feminist movement, but actually you're also providing a far deeper and more mature form of care for women, as there are casualties of biology and culture. Lorcan, you're working very patiently. I'll come to you in a moment to ask for your help on the complexities of the legal situation, though Izzy is an expert too nowadays, of course. But Izzy, would you just tell us a little bit about the effect that your work has? I was very moved when I heard that you described what happened when you would give a woman a leaflet. As you say, they don't have any notion there's an alternative. You've given women leaflets and the situation's turned around wholly dramatically. Could you just give us a little bit of the human history of some of these encounters?
Yeah, and some of these women will need a lot of support and help. Some of them, you know, might be in a lot of debt, difficult situations, as I just mentioned, maybe very difficult relationships. But sometimes it's something very, very simple that can help. I mean, just thinking a while ago, we were standing outside the abortion centre and a young man came out, because often, in fact, usually, certainly nowadays, the boyfriend or the husband would not be allowed to stay with the woman in the abortion centre. And so this young man came out to go down the road, and he stopped just to ask us where the nearest shops were. And we asked him if there was any help that we could offer him or his partner. And he actually said to us, well, he said, actually, I don't want my girlfriend to have an abortion, he said, but I don't want to lose her. And I know this is what she wants, so I'm just going along with it. Anyway, he said, you know, is there any help we can offer? And he said, oh, I don't think so. I think this is just what she wants. He said, anyway, I'll go to the shops and I'll talk to you when I'm on my way back. He went down to the shops. Meanwhile, a young woman came out of the abortion centre. She said there was quite a wait that morning and she was just coming out to try and find her boyfriend. And she said, have you seen him? And I said, oh, I think he might have gone to the shops. And I said, you know, is there any help that we could offer you? And she said, well, the problem is, she said, I don't actually want an abortion. My boyfriend does. And I don't want to lose my boyfriend. As you can see, it turned out they literally had not had a conversation. She was waiting to have the abortion. That was what she was going to have in a few minutes' time. And they had not even had that conversation. No one had encouraged them. I mean, thankfully, the boyfriend came back and we just simply said, I think you two need to tell each other what you've just told us. Beautiful conversation. I mean, they were smiling and hugging and laughing with each other at the end of it. And actually, none of them went back into the abortion centre.
Oh, wow.
Can you imagine if they'd had that conversation an hour later or a day later? What kind of feelings would that have provoked? That they both really wanted this child. And yet, literally, people aren't even encouraged to talk about this. And I was talking to a woman just the other day who was saying she had a list of questions when she went into the abortion centre, and she was told by the staff there, it's as simple as this, do you want the abortion or not? So women aren't even encouraged to talk about this issue. We're fed this idea that there's loads of counselling going on there. Yet that's not what the women are telling us that are coming out of the abortion centres.
Of course, it's like a factory. It's on a mechanistic scale. That's immensely moving. And I think there'll be lots of people listening who find themselves with tears pressing their eyes after that. Lorcan, thank you so much for waiting. If that conversation isn't astonishing enough, just in terms of common sense, the legal conversation becomes almost incoherently impossible. It's very difficult to believe that our society has actually come to a point jurisprudentially where the police are being empowered to ask people if they're praying, to examine a thought crime, and where public space protection orders have got nothing to do with protecting the public at all, but everything to do with depriving people of free speech and the integrity of conscience. Can you just give a very brief summary of the law as it now is and tell us, you know, what's happening? Because as we're speaking, there have been debates in the House of Lords and amendments put down. And maybe give us a sense of where you think this is going to. So a small mini lecture. Thank you so much for your patience. You're a barrister. No. You've been doing this for a while and you're working for ADF. So thank you. We're looking forward to hearing what you've got to say.
Well, the picture is complicated. There are a number of different pieces of legislation and proposals. The legislation that was used to harass cause the arrest of Isabel was the Public Spaces Protection Orders, as she mentioned, under the 2014 Policing Act. And that's been around for some time. It was designed to tackle antisocial behavior. So it also includes provisions in relation to probably more well-known ASBOs. And it generally gives power to local authorities to designate areas where there have been concerns about antisocial behavior and to create a zone where they are so-called protected, giving the police power to intervene when there are certain types of conduct. Now, at the time, concerns were raised that this would result in the type of activity that we saw, which is heavy-handed policing of perfectly reasonable and otherwise legal behavior, praying, being in the zone, handing information, having conversations with people. And that's precisely what has happened around abortion clinics. And unfortunately, it doesn't stop there, because while that legislation was to deal with a particular public order issue and an alleged problem, the abortion lobby now has pressed on to create national legislation which would directly apply to abortion clinics without even the need for a public spaces protection order brought in by a local authority. And that's what's being debated at the moment in the Lords and subsequently will be in the Commons. In relation to the Public Order Act, or Public Order Bill as it is now. And unfortunately, we've seen one jurisdiction in the United Kingdom already bring this in, and that's Northern Ireland, which introduced last year an automatic jurisdiction-wide buffer zone around abortion clinics, effectively meaning that they can ring the police directly and have them intervene without the need for, as I say, the Public Spaces Protection Order, PSPO. That issue then, as to whether or not this was constitutional or in line with the rights secured by the European Convention on Human Rights, that was tested in the Supreme Court, was referred by the Attorney General in a case that was decided in December of last year by the Supreme Court. And I'm sorry to say that it was a unanimous decision. All seven judges who were sitting, including the presiding judge, Lord Reed, decided buffer zones, as they call them, or protection zones or safety zones, there are a number of different terms used, were compliant with the convention, that rights to freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of association could all be curtailed because there was a necessary and rational aim pursued by the public authorities introducing them.
So it's a very long time since I did my law as an undergraduate, and I suddenly lost you at that point. So I heard that what you were saying was the Supreme Court were weighing up a series of competing rights. On the one hand, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience. But on the other hand, you said because the process had been followed adequately, these conceptual rights fell. Explain to me why within our legal system legal process takes priority over jurisprudential value. I've lost touch with that. Can you explain why that's the case?
That's an excellent question. And in short, I would lay the blame at the door of the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. It has been imported into the common law, this concept of proportionality, which effectively gives precedence to the process. And if the outcome of the process satisfies a series of tests they have, then by and large they're satisfied that the curtailing or the balancing of the rights exercise has been correctly achieved. So all of these rights, they would argue, are contingent on the rights of others. They're balanced against each other. You don't have an absolute right to freedom of speech. You don't have an absolute right to freedom of assembly, and so on. And
so just indulge me for a second. Is this the triumph of continental codification against English common law?
I think you could certainly make that argument. And I have in other places that in proportionality assessments, which is what the Supreme Court explicitly engaged in when it was considering whether or not the convention rights had been breached in Northern Ireland, is a wholly continental invention. It's a German concept, really.
Yeah.
And it has been brought in via the European Court of Human Rights and latterly, but it doesn't really matter anymore for the United Kingdom, the Court of Justice of the European Union. And so because it's so well instantiated in those courts and is a mechanism for assessing whether or not a correct balance has been struck between competing rights, judges turn to it very quickly in Europe. And now, because the jurisprudence of those courts, particularly the European Court of Human Rights, obviously, must be taken account of under the 1998 Human Rights Act in this jurisdiction, that mechanism now has found itself as part of the law of the United Kingdom.
No, I find this terribly helpful, because Izzy and I were talking earlier on about, given that we have this incoherent and almost unbelievable situation where values that many of us have taken for granted as part of our liberal Western Christianized democracy have suddenly evaporated in smoke. Izzy, and I hope we'll come back to this, we were thinking, sorry, my clocks are going to go off in a moment of great excitement, that we were saying that cancel culture has taken a hold, allowing for a kind of new victimhood, with people being unwilling to think about the different competing claims of the cancellers and cancellees. But we've got an unhappy coincidence where just at this moment, the way in which our jurisprudence and our laws work are that we become subject to process rather than value. So in neither case are we able to actually give a proper examination to the value systems that lie at the heart of trying to make enormously complex decisions between competing value. Well, this is, I mean, it sounds like a tragic coincidence, but the combination is, the effect is to stop us talking about the values that matter so much. Thank you very much. That's helped me clear my head. I'm sorry if I've taken other people away from the main topic, but that's helped me enormously. So let's get back to where we are now. So the values that were put before the Supreme Court were held to be lost in terms of the hierarchy of the importance of process. Where does that take us now?
Well, it puts us in the very unfortunate position that in Northern Ireland, at least, the view is of the highest judicial authority in this country that the law which prohibits all of the activities that we're concerned about, including influencing and prayer, was deemed to be appropriate and proportionate and so on. And it means now that has given wind to the sails of those who wish to introduce a similar provision in the law of Scotland and in this country, in England and Wales as well. And so both, I think it's fair to say, Nicola Sturgeon and others in Scotland have said that they regard the Supreme Court decision on the Northern Ireland case now as giving them the green light.
Setting a precedent, sure.
Yeah. And then in the Lords and the Commons, politicians have obviously taken note of it. And they are saying now as well that as far as they're concerned, there's no longer a strong argument to be made that what they're proposing is in breach of human rights law, at least. So that leaves us in a bizarre situation where the mechanisms of the European Court of Human Rights, as we were discussing a moment ago, have been used here to trump common sense and the longstanding traditions of civil liberties in this country. In other words, because the mechanism was correct, the outcome must have been proportionate, or at least within the margin of proportionality that the authorities are allowed by the judicial branch.
Let's go for the always not lost thing. Our minds are traveling in the same direction. Let's start at the other end. And that is, are there no politicians who, seeing that the outcome of this particular process has become ludicrous and inhospitable to some of our most profoundly valued rights, are so astonished that a woman like Isabel can be asked what she's praying for by the police and then arrested? Is there no democratic kickback against the ludicrousness of the outcome, saying, well, okay, clearly the process is logical, the process is legal, the process is not going to be overturned in the High Court, but nonetheless, equity in the old-fashioned sense demands that we take hold of the situation and reconfigure the way in which the law works, because we can't have people being arrested for thought crime. Is there no traction for that at all? What's happening with that?
There is some traction in the Conservative Party. There are some politicians who have expressed concern on this. I see publicly Andrew Luhr, for example, and I think Fiona Bruce and others who have expressed concern that this, as you say, is such a draconian measure, really, considering that I'm not a legal historian, but perhaps since the Reformation is the first time that we've arrived at a point where thought crime is now in the statutes of this country. What it means, though, in effect, when you have the Labour Party, let's say, who originally proposed some of these amendments in the Commons, supported by Conservative peers then in the House of Lords, is that I think that there is a strong cohort, let's say, in the Commons for seeking to outlaw prayer and under the guise of influencing within the buffer zone. What that means in terms of amending it, I know amendments are being discussed and will presumably be put down, and hopefully common sense will reign. People will, even people who are and otherwise is supportive of abortion, may say that this is a free speech issue, this is a freedom of association issue, and that criminalizing you know, two people in a public place having a discussion with each other based solely on what the discussion is about is a totally unwarranted and unnecessary step. And the point could also be made, although I'm not particularly persuaded by it, that the circumstances of the situation in Northern Ireland can be distinguished from that in England and Wales, so that there's no need to automatically apply the Supreme Court decision as being, or a decision rather that applies in every circumstance across the United Kingdom in all jurisdictions. And I think that that point will be made, and hopefully it will persuade other members of the Parliament to see that it's worth looking again at whether or not these kind of laws are in breach of human rights, and whether or not there is a legitimate freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, freedom of expression, derogation that ought to be made, or a defense that ought to be put in the law. Alas, it's always the case when you're talking about abortion, whether it's in medical practice or the law or even in international affairs. I have some experience seeing this at the United Nations and in the European Union, that there's a distortion effect, as famously the late Antonin Scalia talked about in the United States, around this issue, that people who would otherwise be willing to discuss freedom of speech, freedom of religion questions quite rationally, when it comes to abortion, they suddenly freeze and say, well, you know, here I think we should be allowed to criminalize silent prayer, and we should be allowed to criminalize offers of help and assistance.
I mean, you've answered the question. Thank you so much. There's a spiritual dimension. Do you want to say anything about the spiritual dimension as a barrister? Move out of your primary area of expertise into your secondary one.
Well, as a barrister, but as a Catholic as well, I've my experience of this in Brussels, in Strasbourg, in Geneva, in New York, working in the kind of area of international law, human rights law, has been that when we arrive at the issue of abortion, the intensity of the lobbying, the intensity of the emotions, the unwillingness of allies in other areas to cooperate with you and reasonable amendments to documents or proposals is extraordinary. Again and again, to take the area I've probably most experienced in, the European Court of Human Rights, longstanding practice and procedure of the court is discarded to facilitate abortion cases. There are a whole series of cases being taken against Poland at the moment, hundreds of cases, that have not even gone through the domestic Polish courts, which is a requirement in the law of the European Convention and the European Court of Human Rights, that only is discarded in very narrow circumstances. Yet the court has accepted hundreds of these cases that have never gone before a Polish court. So that's one small example of again and again, I've seen over the years that when it comes to abortion, there is a distortion of certainly legal practice and I would say common sense. And we know as well in medical practice as well that very often longstanding concepts are set aside to facilitate abortion. And that happened. I'm an Irishman, and we saw in Ireland that they tried to bring abortion law in 2013, where somebody was suicidal, that they could have an abortion as a solution to a suicidal crisis. So the only place in the world where suicide could be cured by an abortion, despite the fact there was absolutely no evidence to support that. But we saw the medical associations all stepped aside, refused to say anything publicly. And we saw, again, medical practice, in addition to the law, being distorted by the effects of abortion. So I think that we can, as I say, my experience over the years of dealing with this in different jurisdictions has been to firmly arrive at the conclusion that there's a clear and undeniable spiritual dimension on this issue. If on many others, of course, but on this, it's so clear and explicit.
Izzy, I'll ask you to offer your insights in a moment. But let me just say, for in case there's anyone listening who's not a Catholic or not a Christian, what one of the reasons that we turn to a spiritual solution is that as a rational Christian who believes in the supernatural, the point at which I look for spiritual responses is the point at which the rational one becomes irrational. And so rationality requires consistency. And if following a rational, logical, empirical avenue of exploration suddenly hits up against contradiction, that at that point one's entitled to say, this is not the best language of exploration and inquiry. Is there another one? And one of the reasons people become Christians is because they discover that a metaphysical explanation or narrative can suddenly make sense of a situation where the empirical, rational one doesn't. And I think that's where we've arrived at here. What you've described, Lorcan, very helpfully and clearly, is that in terms of rational values that we share and have built our society on, suddenly abortion seems to throw a wrench into the engine. And there is no consistency of rationality. And we're entitled, therefore, to ask what other effects are being brought to bear on this. And the thing I think that causes me enormous alarm is the way in which we philosophically and spiritually appear to have entered into something that Freud was really rather good at, unusually, which is this notion of thanatos, a death culture. And the death culture seems to be direct primarily against to damage our children and to destroy our children, to bring us to infertility and lack of procreation. And this is happening both in terms of the iniquitous sexualization of children, the perversion of the most innocent, but most emphatically, the killing of the children. And both in scripture and the history of religion, we've seen religions that have sacrificed children to their gods. And it's very hard, if one's taking a philosophical view of the history of religion, not to come to the conclusion that we have started sacrificing our children on the altar of a different divinity, because the gods we're worshipping require the sacrifice, and therefore it must not be questioned. It's a form of counter-holiness. Izzy, how do you deal with your sense of what's spiritually at stake here, the irrationality of the abortionists and the anger, the hatred, the misrepresentation, the unwillingness to discuss, compromise, whatever? What can you give us some kind of insight into what you feel you've been struggling with at a spiritual level as a Catholic, working for our Lord, for the Church, and for the sanctity of the unborn?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you said, and I think, you know, an indication of why the discussion is being shut down is because it's such an inconsistent position to hold. If you want to support abortion, at some level, you have to be supporting something very inconsistent, like you say, either when life begins or somehow saying that this helps a woman to take the life of her own child, and in no other circumstances would we provide that as a solution. And that's often an indication that something spiritual, in a negative way, is going on, because as we know, Satan is irrational by his nature, is illogical. But I also think that we can look at this in a good way, in as much as why do people want to shut down prayer so much? And we can see, particularly maybe with the situation that I've been involved in most recently, it was simply just prayer. I wasn't even talking to anyone. The abortion centre wasn't even open. I couldn't possibly have been intimidating service users, which is what I was charged with. There were no service users there. Why were people so concerned about that? And I think the enemy, and when I say the enemy, I'm not talking about people, I'm not talking about flesh and blood, I'm talking about the spiritual enemy, knows the power of prayer, even silent prayer, and he recognises it more than we often do. That's why it's so important that prayer is shut down. And I think in a way that should be a reassurance to us, because even those with a strong faith can sometimes have those days when they think, you know, am I really making a difference?
It's quite incredible that you know, we sink to our knees and we begin to lose heart and think, oh, I'm not really sure my prayers are being taken seriously, only to discover that the police take them immensely seriously. And if the police are taking them seriously, it's because something has inspired them in the literal sense to take them seriously. And actually, we're dealing with a different value system. And both value systems, ours and this alternative one, seem to take prayer very seriously. So we might as well get on with the act ourselves and do it. As you say, paradoxically, it's the most extraordinary affirmation of a metaphysical point of view on life and the reality and the importance of prayer. If the police and the enemy, spiritual enemy, don't want us to do it, let's keep at it.
And I think also, if we look at the Gospels, we see, you know, when our Lord was suffering and dying on the cross, you know, the most innocent of the most innocent, his mother didn't stay at home and quietly pray by herself. She came out and publicly witnessed at the foot of the cross. And I think that's, the most perfect role model for us to follow, really. Now, when we see innocent children who are dying in abortion centres, or women being given pills there, even though the abortion sometimes happens at home, we shouldn't be just praying at home. And I know sometimes people have talked about this, about why can't you just pray in your church? Why can't you just pray at home? It is important we pray in our homes. It is important we pray in our churches, of course. But our prayer actually at a place is very powerful. And that's what we see in the Gospels. That is a kind of gospel value in itself, to be present at a place where you pray. There is huge value in that. And that is what we learn from the Gospels, from the very life of Christ himself, that there's a power in presence. And we shouldn't ignore that. And I think sometimes people misinterpret this idea of like, oh, well, you know, you shouldn't be doing prayers for show. That's not why we do them. We're not doing a prayer for show. Our prayers should be there whether people are looking at us or not, whether people are aware we're praying. On that particular day when I was arrested, there was not any manifestation of my prayer. I wasn't holding rosary beads or, you know, waving a crucifix. I was just something going on in my own head.
Did they not say, is your hand in your pocket? I presume that they were asking you that in case you had a rosary in your pocket. Am I right about that, or did I misinterpret it?
I did have a rosary in my pocket, as you might have seen when my pockets were emptied by a police officer on the street.
I may have misheard, but I thought that the police were asking whether you had your hand in your pockets because they were concerned that you might be praying the rosary. Like you, I carry a rosary in my pocket, and usually when my hand goes into my pocket, it's a sign that I'm starting to pray the rosary. And I wondered whether the police had cottoned on to our cultural predilections or not. But maybe I may have put two and two together and got four. Izzy, I just want to ask you back to the rational, where some of us find ourselves sometimes more, you know, on more usual foundations. What are the things that you've discovered that have had most effect on the argument? I still find myself responding viscerally to pictures of embryos in the womb where the child is sucking its thumb or moving in a perfectly human way, almost like a, you know, like a child in a playgroup. But when it comes to trying to explain to people that hypothetically, at least, it's not unreasonable to consider that the child is fully human in the womb, are there conversations, discussions, arguments, ideas that have more purchase than others for people?
I find that it's important to go back to the core of the issue. And I find that part of the problem is that so often we'll start at what I call point C, which is things like, what about if a woman's raped and becomes pregnant? You know, what about if a mother's life's in danger? We need to actually get back and look at, what does it mean to be pregnant? And if you and I can't agree on what it means for a woman to be pregnant, we're never going to have a meaningful conversation about abortion. So I think it's so important to be able to answer that question and come to a conclusion we can both agree on before we go forward with any of these other questions, which need to also be talked about. And I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about those questions. They're very important. But we've got to lay that foundation first and both find that common ground. What does pregnancy mean? And of course, when a woman's pregnant, we know right at the moment of conception, a new human life has started, which is unique, which is, you know, not distinct from mother and father. And once we've established that, we can then look at, well, what does abortion do to that human life? And again, sensitively, that question needs to be answered before we can then look at, well, is it right or wrong? Is it acceptable in this situation or that situation to have an abortion? Because then we can look at, for instance, the terrible traumatic situation of rape and think, is it going to help the mother to take the life of her own child? Because that's what we've established it is. Is that somehow solving her problems? Is that going to do away with the rape? But I think unless we've actually established that foundation of what pregnancy is first, other discussions can just go round and round in circles and be very unproductive, often very heated, but not really getting anywhere. So I think calmly laying those foundations first of finding out what pregnancy actually is and being honest about that before we move forward with the other more difficult but necessary topics connected to it.
I'm hoping the people who have been sufficiently moved listening to the conversations we've had that they'll want to join those who pray. But let me both ask you in terms of campaigning, Lorcan first, and then Isabel give you the last word. Legally, in terms of legal representation, in terms of political process, if people wanted to do anything like writing to their MPs, do you have any advice, any encouragement, any suggestions you can give pragmatically within the area that you're working in about where the way people can help or be supportive or feel that they can bring their own efforts to make any change? Is there anything we can do?
I think it is actually important to write to your MPs. This is a live parliamentary issue. It will be coming back to the Commons in, we're not exactly sure of the timetable yet, but probably towards the end of this month or the beginning of March, and now maybe later. But nonetheless, this is an area that they are being lobbied on by the abortion lobby. And so they will want to hear from others. There is a constituency within above all parties, I would suggest, that values freedom of expression. So highlighting the nature of how restrictive this will be on freedom of expression, freedom of thought is valuable and I think worthwhile. So at least politicians cannot claim that they haven't been contacted by their constituents in relation to that. In terms of bearing witness, Isabel and others have enormous experience of doing this in a way that is appropriate and actually useful and beneficial. And so I think what I would encourage people to do is to reach out, support Isabel, support organizations that have trained and carefully constructed their activities in a way that is constructive over the years for women. And most importantly, and I think this I would say it goes without saying, but it probably doesn't, is to pray for Isabel, to pray for Adam Smith Connor, and to pray for others who have been subjected to police harassment and arrest. And I think as well, it's clear that the legal process isn't over in Isabel's case. So that's something to keep in mind as a specific prayer intention. And for all of those who for many, many years and continue to support women in crisis pregnancies.
Isabel, when I saw you being arrested, my first emotional and rather immature reaction was to want to grab a rosary, get a train ticket, travel an hour to Birmingham and come and join you on the streets and be arrested with you. This may be counterproductive, however, despite the fact it might be emotionally satisfactory. What should we be doing to help you and your witness and at this stage in relationship to our struggle with the law and public consciousness of the issues?
Yeah, I think many people are quite outraged with the PSPOs and the restrictions of them and also the thought of, you know, further restrictions with possible buffer zones. But I think it's worth just thinking, well, at the moment, we recognise there's, what, I think about 5 PSPOs in England that are there. Most abortion centres don't have PSPOs outside them. Why aren't we praying at those? And even the ones that do have PSPOs, there's often a campaign going outside those buffer zones. It often isn't the PSPO or the buffer zone that's stopping many people from going there, if we're totally honest. It's our own fears or our own busyness, or maybe just that kind of lack of faith in believing in the power of that public witness and prayer, or maybe just not understanding the issue and really recognizing the difference it can make. So many people have maybe fallen into that trap of thinking, oh yes, well, when a woman goes to an abortion center, she's made up her mind. That's so often not the case, or it's often the case because she hasn't been offered with any alternatives. So
if really people want to support you, how would they get in touch with you and your organization so that they can get the information they need?
40 Days for Life is starting very soon on Ash Wednesday, which is the 22nd of February. So there's campaigns going around the country, so they can go to the 40 Days for Life website. Good Counsel Network run vigils. Go to their website, get in contact, or also contact me at March for Life. You know, I'm happy to help people if they want to start up their own vigil and look at how they can do that, whether it's through one of these organisations or just something, you know, smaller. But I definitely want to encourage people to do that. We go there to help women, which we do, but spiritually, we also benefit ourselves from doing this, as is always the case. And I really want to encourage people. Yes, it can be difficult at times, but then anything that's worthwhile is usually difficult, and this is very, very worthwhile.
Lorcan Price, Isabel Von Spruce, thank you both very much indeed. Very grateful.